Welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast, where we are embracing the journey. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. Today's conversation is about cats. But before you decide you're not a cat person, stay with me. As I listened to Deborah's story, I realized this conversation could just as easily be about a food bank, a hospice society, a wildlife rescue, a literacy program, or any organization that's quietly making life better in its community. At its heart, this isn't really a conversation about cats. It's a conversation about what happens when ordinary people decide they can no longer look the other way. Deborah never planned to build a rescue organization. She simply helped where she saw a need, and one small act of kindness gradually became a mission that has now touched thousands of lives, both animal and human. Along the way, we talk about volunteering, fostering, giving, legacy, the surprising power of empathy, and why getting older might actually be the perfect time to color outside the lines and make a difference in whatever way speaks to your heart. Whether you share your home with a cat, a dog, or no pets at all, I think you'll find something in this conversation that reaches beyond animal rescue and reminds us that every one of us still has something valuable to offer. Listen now to my conversation with Deborah Phelan McGaldy. Sometimes the most meaningful journeys begin with something small, a neighbor needing help, a problem that nobody else seems ready to solve, or simply a moment when you decide you can't look away. My guest today didn't set out to build a cat rescue organization, I don't think. What started as helping care for a group of feral cats grew into Cat Paws, a nonprofit organization that has spent more than 15 years rescuing vulnerable cats and kittens, supporting spay and neuter programs, educating communities, and even bringing comfort and companionship to seniors through therapy cat visits. Along the way, Deborah has combined compassion, business sense, persistence, and a deep belief that every animal deserves a chance at a safe and cherished life. Today, we're going to talk about that journey, what she's learned along the way, and how ordinary people can make an extraordinary difference in the lives of animals. Deborah Phelan McGaldy, welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast, where we are embracing the journey.
Thank you so very much for having me and for letting me talk about, what we do.
Yeah, no. Now, I said that you never intended to start a cat rescue or to support a cat rescue organization. Is that true? And if it is, what was the what's the the reasoning?
How it started and where it's going. That is largely true, actually. I 20 something, a little over 20 years ago, I had the flexibility in my job of working from home. So I started fostering for a local shelter here in this little beach town where I am now in Southern California. And that was great. I actually wound up with learning how to do what they call bottle babies, the very smallest, little bottle fed kittens. So I had the flexibility of working from home and taking a break and feeding, kittens and tending to kittens, and it was all good. And then I did meet the namesake of our organization, Helen Sanders, in the early 2000s, and she was a pioneer in what they is now known as TNR, trap, neuter, return, before that was even really a thing that people knew about, and trapped the kitten, the cats on the jetty, the rocks that jut into the ocean just down the street here. And I met her in the alley. I was putting food and water out for this stray cat that would hang around my house, and she pedaled her little trike bike down the alley and kind of barked at me like, "Are you taking care of truffles?" And I guess I am. I guess I am. And that's kind of how we met. And then she passed away in 2005. There were some cats that were still alive at the time of her passing, and another friend of hers, a good friend of hers, was raising money to buy food to care for them. And over the next several years, one thing led to another, and I did the IRS 501c3 filing, the paperwork filing to become a, a registered
Nonprofit.
legitimate nonprofit. And that was kind of going to be the end of it. It's kind of like, here you go. And but just, one thing led to another. And as you said in your intro, you see things and can't necessarily turn away. And it's, I saw more need. You can't unsee things. You can't unknow things. And I just saw more to do and kind of started doing it, I guess. And one thing led to another. And we've got a great team of fosters and volunteers, and we've grown into a number of areas and then impacted at this point thousands of lives, both cat and human, actually.
Yeah, I bet. Now, was it sort of a slippery slope into involvement, or was there sort of a moment when you said, I'm either in or I'm not in?
Yeah, no, it was pretty much a straight downhill luge ride. There was some consciousness of, wow, I'm getting, this is getting a little deeper than this will become all encompassing. And it kind of is, and it kind of was. So, yeah, I mean, there was consciousness to it, that I knew that, like I said, you see more need, and for me, I just wanted to do more and to find different ways to interject solution into the problem, and the problem being so many homeless animals, and specifically cats, and finding different paths to address that problem.
Now, did cats present because of Helen Saunders? Or, like, are you a cat person or are you just an animal lover?
I think in animals in general, I mean, I've had
Okay.
cats all my life, just growing up and through my adulthood, and I've always I, they've always been they're fascinating creatures. But I like all animals. I've made kind of an interesting transition from growing up in a very rural part of the North Woods in this country, very northern Wisconsin, where deer hunting, and I used to hunt, and I used to, hunt and eat what I killed, to vegetarian, over the years, and it's a transition, just learning more and appreciating more about the sentient nature of the beings that share our planet with us. And trying to be more respectful of that and appreciative. And cats in particular, I guess I've always felt some kinship and some understanding with them. I mean, they're complex little beings in many ways. And I think they will give someone what that person puts into them. They will reflect the level of engagement that someone has with them. They're aloof if they're ignored, and they're affectionate when they're cared for and they feel loved and safe.
You're making me feel better already. I've always considered myself a dog person, and I ended up with a cat, which was a choice. That was all right. But he was the coolest cat. Oh my goodness. And after he passed, I said I can never have another cat because they will never measure up. But it sounds like if I put in the time, it would be fine.
They're
So,
all very different. I mean,
yeah.
I've had a lot of cats over my life, and they all have very distinct personalities, very different. But I do feel that they reflect more of what they're given than dog. I think dogs are wonderful. I mean,
Pushovers.
they're so unconditional and loving, and they are outward focused. They focus more on their person than their own needs. Cats are pretty narcissistic in some ways. Some are, but they can also be intensely loyal. I've had, just remarkably loyal cats that were very attuned to my emotional state and my needs, whether they wanted to admit it or not, they were.
When I had my cat, his name was Cat. When I had Cat, I lived in probably a similar area that you grew up in. And one night he was driving me crazy. And the next day I found out there was a reason why. And I think that was the day that I apologized profusely for not listening to him and then really tuned into everything he was saying after that. So, yeah. But okay, so you have a bachelor's in psychology and an MBA. Has that helped you build cat paws?
Well, the psychology one did. No, I'm just kidding.
It did.
like crazy cat people, right? The present company included here, me. I think it allowed me to, even though it's a very different world in trying to manage and organize and build a nonprofit than it is a for-profit business, it did allow me to at least have a framework to bring some structure and organization to the field. But there are profound differences. I mean, I'm dealing, we're a volunteer, primarily volunteer and volunteer run organization. And volunteer, the relationship with a volunteer group is obviously quite different than it is with employees and the financial transactionary nature of employee, you do this, I give you that, right? It's a very different environment that way. But one thing that I think maybe has helped, and one thing I like to think our organization brings is a customer service focus. We try to make the people that interact with our organization in various ways, whether they're adopters or even our own internal team, people who bring in cats to our spay-neuter clinics. We try to give them, personal, individual service. We try to make it a good experience for all involved. And that's important to me. And follow up and getting back to people is part of how I run my company. And I think that, and I've tried to instill that into our corporate culture, as it were, as a nonprofit also.
I'm glad you pointed out the difference between employees and volunteers. I was a volunteer manager in a people-centered universe at one point in time. And just as cats have their own personalities, so do volunteers. So sometimes it can be a little bit of work there. I want to warn our listeners that it's going to get a little sad at times, our conversation, but we're going to come out the other end. So I hope you, listeners, I hope you stay with us. Now, a lot of people assume that animal shelters and rescues have things under control, but I take it you see a different reality many days.
Yeah, unfortunately, there is a somewhat different reality, and it is in the realm I deal with, which is cats. And this is also it's also a different, unfortunate reality for dogs too, in many parts of the country, especially larger dogs. Smaller dogs, I think, tend to get adopted more. They're maybe easier to have in apartments and whatnot, but there's a big problem with large dogs getting out of shelters alive, frankly. And for cats, one of the most vulnerable populations in an animal shelter, and by that I mean the one most likely to not leave alive, are kittens under about 4 or 5 weeks of age. And the reason for that is, if they're not yet eating on their own, they can't be left overnight. I mean, they have to be, depending on age, they have to be fed, every few hours potentially. Shelters are not open typically. Most shelters are not staffed, 24 hours a day. So you cannot responsibly leave a 1 week old kitten that has to be fed, every 2, 3 hours, from 5 o'clock at night till 8 o'clock the next morning. That you cannot do that. So typically, if those kittens are brought in, people find them, bring them in, and if there's no other source of intervention, a rescue taking them, or even a citizen being willing to care for them. The end of day, end of, closing time is usually end of kitten.
Wow, I never think about that. Now, you also talk about kitten season. What exactly is that? Like, what's happening and why is it such a crisis? Or is it the crisis because there's so many? And you've just explained that.
That is the crisis. There's more than kittens that are being found and brought into shelters and rescues and can be accommodated and can be supported to survive. And what kitten season means in this part of the country, because of the temperate climate, kitten season is really pretty much almost year round. I mean, it slows down a little bit. In the colder months, what passes for winter here, which is a little bit chillier by the beach and rainy, but it never really quite stops. And what that kitten season means is the mating season basically, when and the free roaming cats, community feral stray, whatever we might want to call them, they constitute the majority of the unwanted litters. I mean, owned cats do too, if people let their own cats out and they haven't been fixed. But I think I read stats that it's like 80% of the unwanted litters are born to free roaming, community cats, feral stray, whatever the terminology. And that is a product of the more temperate the climate, the more cats are out there mating, and they are just enormously prolific and fecund. I mean, a kitten really can get pregnant at 4 months old. I mean, if you think about that, like basically 16 weeks old, right? Not even yet full grown. Gestation is approximately 63 days. So if you do that math, right, they can have kittens by the time they're 6, 7 months old. I actually had a cat at one point that was trapped. She was a feral cat. At 7 months old, she already had two kittens. And the they can have then two or three litters a year. Their progeny can have another litter or a couple litters. So it's enormously daunting exponential growth of cats from seeing, and people tell us this all the time. They'll say, well, I saw a couple in my backyard a couple of years ago, and now there's like 20. It's like, yeah, that's how that happens. So, and that's what kitten season is. It's when that, unchecked mating and breeding and fighting over territory and all these unwanted litters flooding into shelters that are not equipped to handle them. Follow the shelter. I'm not impugning. I want to make it clear. I'm not impugning shelters. This is a it's just the sheer volume of it, and there are limitations to capacity.
Yeah, I have a friend in California who found two brand new kittens in her garage one morning, and still had the umbilicus attached, like mom had disappeared. And so she took them in, and she actually found out, like she contacted, I don't know, it was a shelter or somebody that knew what they were talking about, and learned how to feed these kittens. Now, unfortunately, there was no hope for one of them, but this is I don't know how many years ago, and she still has the other one who grew up. And if it was a foster, it was a failed foster because she just fell in love. Mind you, she's also the type of woman that almost has more rescues in her home than she has people. So, but is that a possibility if somebody's willing to put in the time and the effort, like just get the information and then once that, how old does a kitten have to be like weaned?
Well, it's somewhat kitten dependent, but I've had kittens that just picked up eating on their own at 4 weeks. I mean, I start putting out food and they just picked it right up at 4 weeks old. I've had some that at 6 weeks old would still cry for a bottle. So, but somewhere in that 4 to 6 week time frame, typically, if they're And good on your friend. I mean, that's a tough thing to take them from that small at birth when they've had really very little to no contact, even colostrum from the mother's milk. I mean, it's, she did great to even be able to save one. I mean, even with mom present, they still have a high mortality rate. So yeah, she did a wonderful thing. And people, in fact, we have a whole program about people being, citizen rescuers. We give them a kit of bottles and formula and supplies and say, here, and a care guide and links to videos, and here, you can do this. So yeah, I mean, people do it all the time, and we have to learn somewhere. I mean, I've said I've done a number of neonatal kitten care classes, and one thing I try to emphasize is that humans aren't born knowing how to take care of a newborn kitten, right? I mean, this is not instinctive to us. We have to learn this. I mean, humans are really barely born knowing how to take care of a newborn human, right? So, I mean, so you really don't know, to kitten, it has to be learned. There's no, instinctive memory on this. But the good news is, in the last 20 something years that I have done that, there is just a plethora of online, there's videos about everything, bottle feeding, flea treatment. I mean, how to keep them warm, how to get them warm, how to help them, eliminate. I mean, just every aspect of baby kitten care you can now find on YouTube online.
Yeah. So if somebody comes across a deserted brand new litter and they're willing to put in that, so say 6 to 8 weeks of bottle feeding and then sort of weaning onto food, if they just offer to do that, but they don't have the wherewithal to keep, two, four, six cats, can they then come to you and say, okay, we've gotten the kittens through the hard part, and then you take over from there? Is that a possibility?
Typically, what our organization focuses on, because we only have so many foster families ourselves, are the cats at shelters that are at risk of not making it out alive. So typically, we go to the shelters first and almost
Oh, okay.
exclusively, and take those out. Now, what we can do with the people who have, raised kittens, and we mentor them. We can even provide them some supplies. We can do what we call courtesy posts online on our website to help them get the kittens adopted. But we generally don't actually take them into our
Okay.
organization. But at that point, some shelters, once the kittens are weaned and eating on their own, shelters are in a much better position to be able to take them if they're, going to take them, because then they can stay overnight. The kittens can stay overnight. They don't have to be fed through the night.
Right. Can a person, I've got so many questions. Is there any easy way to find out, like if a shelter says it's a no-kill shelter, is it a no-kill shelter? Or is that just hopefully it's a no-kill shelter?
Well, I think, shelters vary in their own policies and procedures, and I think what is needed there is just to have a really candid conversation with the shelter about, what are your policies? What under what circumstances do you euthanize? What is the criteria? And then in most, some shelters are private, but for the most part, the ones that I'm familiar with and we work with mostly are at least at some part public taxpayer money funded. So their records, their data, and their statistics should be publicly available if someone wants to, go that far into it, or simply just have a conversation with them.
Right. Okay, so we go from kittens. We've got them through that first 8 weeks. They will become cats in the very near future. Talk to us about so the spay and neuter programs.
Okay, we since our inception in 2010, we've always had had in our mind that spay neuter is foundational to addressing this problem. I mean, that Helen's work was trap neuter return, get them fixed so they wouldn't keep making more homeless cats. So for years, we had our own voucher a system where we would work with clinics and just send people there, and we'd pay, X amount, sometimes all of the spay-neuter cost. But especially when COVID hit, the availability of appointments, became so difficult. And also, even before that, a lot of clinics didn't want to deal with, what they considered feral cats. They just weren't set up to deal with that. So over time, over in the last 3 years, we finally brought the spay-neuter clinic aspect in-house, and integrated it into our organization. And we did that initially with a trailer that we bought, especially had purpose-built a spay-neuter surgical trailer that we used for the first really almost 2 years. And then early last spring, we opened an actual brick-and-mortar surgical suite. We do two spay-neuter clinics a week now.
Wow. So how many cats would that be?
Yeah, we do about we can do 25 to 30 in a day, typically. And since the inception of our program, right about 3 years ago, we have, and remember, this is just one aspect of our organization, but since the inception, we are closing in on 4,000 cats spayed and neutered as of this date in June.
Okay, I'm going to sneak this question in because you talk about thousands of cats, but it's not like bulk cats. There's got to be a few that really hit you in the heart bone, for lack of not the funny bone, but it's sort of your heart. Is there a story or two that you could tell us about specific cats that have come through and sort of?
Well, there's been a number of them actually, and I understand this because of that cat I took care of all those years ago when I met Helen. But a lot of these cats are just cats that people see just hanging around their neighborhood, down the street, in the alley, in the bushes, right? And they sometimes aren't ever able to even touch them, let alone pick them up and hug them and do all the stuff that you would do with your own cat. And they have to be trapped. I mean, they set a trap, they put food in it, the door closes, and the cats are hauled into the surgery. But it's amazing how attached people can get, and I was to that cat so many years ago that I was never able to even touch. And we have a couple of stories. There was a little, orange, female that had had came in, was trapped, brought in for spay, and she had a it turned out she had a condition, a disease starting called pyometra, which is a lethal uterine infection that goes very quickly, and she would have died very badly, out there, alone, if she'd not been brought in. But she was spayed, that completely eliminated that progression of that disease. And we've since gotten pictures of her, kind of li living her life out there, hanging around this person's house. And I mean, people get attached. They see them, they become part of their lives.
Oh, that's good. Now, many listeners, they love animals, but they aren't sure how they can help. Where would you tell them to start?
Well, in every community that is within earshot today, there are organizations and shelters that need help. They need volunteers, they need foster homes, they need money, and even just offering to, like, maybe go to an event or donate a few dollars, or even maybe just go in and just walk a shelter dog. I mean, it's just any number of ways that people can help in small ways or big ways, however much they can be involved. There's some animal organization, some animal that needs help everywhere. I mean, it's a nationwide, it's a worldwide problem, actually.
And I don't know if this next question is easily answered, but talk to us about fostering. What does that entail?
Well, it we have it, basically fostering, and for us anyway, our experience of fostering is we as an organization provide the food, the supplies, the veterinary care. If we do intake the animal, we also we'll try, we'll use our resources to find the animal a home. If a home is an adopter home is a possibility, there are certain instances where that is not even the goal. And I'll explain that in a moment, because we have fostering opportunities from, the one day old kitten that you got to get up every two hours to feed, to, the 13-year-old cat with chronic kidney disease and cancer, who is in the shelter and whose life is about to be ended there, understandably. But that, to take that cat out into and give that cat one last home, which is what we call hospice care fostering, or sometimes called hospice. And in that scenario, the goal is to not necessarily find an adopter, is to just, place the cat into a foster home for, the balance of his or her life, to, like I said, give that cat one last home, which is, I've done both ends of that spectrum. And that's a very special kind of fostering too.
So if someone's got big heart, space, very little finances, this sounds like something that they could do.
I mean, like I said, as an organization, we cover everything.
Okay, so there's other listeners who, a lot of people out there who support charities. What should they look for when deciding if an animal rescue organization should get their money?
Well, that's an interesting question. There's certain organizations on just online that evaluate charities, like Charity Navigator, I think, is one. There's a few others, GuideStar, I'm not sure. So they can look at that, but that sometimes only gives you a partial snapshot. I mean, one really good way, if they want to, spend a little time, is volunteer for the organization for a while. I mean, you get to know it, see how they treat their volunteers, see how they treat the public, see how they treat the animals in their care. I mean, I think that gives you an up close and personal and uniquely valid perspective to evaluate an organization.
I knew briefly a number of years ago a woman who had arrived here with 19 cats. As she got older and the cats were passing on themselves, she said she was never going to adopt another cat because nobody could take as good a care of it as she could. This leads into legacy giving. What is legacy giving, and how does a person make that a part of their legacy?
Well, are you referring really to a state, like estate planning kind of thing?
Probably, yeah. I mean, I realize,
Okay.
you can just leave, like my aunt did, leave a bulk amount to an organization. But I understand legacy giving can also include either starting from today, and I still won't die for a few years, and just contribute monthly. But then I understand you can also set up almost like a trust that would feed money in on a regular basis after death.
Yeah, there, that's a whole genre of law, estate law, that I'm really kind of not qualified to give more than, just a really broad brush opinion about. But I know that there are, irrevocable trusts that people can set up, that they can direct to make gifts every year. They can do, like we have some donors disperse when they have to do the oh my God, I'm blanking on it. Like the RMDs, like the required minimum distributions every year out of an investment vehicle. They have that set up to just donate to us rather than claim it as income. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, that touches on areas of estate plan, estate tax law that, I way beyond my pay grade, right? But I mean, I'm certainly happy to have that conversation with somebody if they're interested in setting something up and putting them together with somebody who actually can speak to it knowledgeably. But there's and I know there's other vehicles where people can, I think even they can donate like appreciated stock, and take it and take the value of the deduction of the appreciated stock, but not be, not have to claim the capital gains income. So, I mean, I know there's various ways to, to give in ways that at least partially benefit the donor tax-wise too. That's a whole, like, a whole area of law.
Okay. You had
That's
an
a whole,
MBA. I thought you knew everything.
How I don't know that part. I know sales and marketing more than
Yeah,
anything,
no, I know. I'm
but
teasing.
yeah. And some, I think there's even one where I think people can donate like a fairly major asset, like a house, for example, and they get the some they get like an, a distribution investment income out of it for a certain period of time. There's, I
Okay.
mean, there's a number of creative vehicles, but again, that takes an estate lawyer
Yeah.
to set
So
that kind of thing
listeners
up.
should get in touch with the estate planner, and then the two of you can, or two of them can bring you into the conversation.
Please, yes.
Okay. Now, would donations be sort of specific, or like if we just donate to Cat Paws, or would a person say, Cat Paws, here's a certain amount of money to be spent on spay and neutering?
People do both. In fact, on our website, we have I have actually different funds set up where people can donate to general fund. That means, wherever the need is, greatest, wherever the funds need to be. There is also a specific spay and neuter fund that they can donate to. We have another fund that is a special medical needs fund. Which is like some of the complicated surgeries and illnesses that we deal with all the time, for to take care of, help pay those veterinary expenses. So people can do a general donation. They can do a what's called a restricted donation, where the money is to be, spent for, X amount, for this purpose. So, people can structure that however they, wherever their passion is.
Where in your organization, where would the greatest need be? Like if I were just to say to you, I have $100 to donate, but I want it to go make some impact.
Well, gosh, $100 would it go towards the bulk of the expense of spaying one cat, for example.
Yeah, that's crazy. Okay, looking through, sorry, one of my eyes drift over here. I've got your website open on my other monitor. You've got a story on there about Benny and the connection between, and listeners, spoiler alert, the connection between animal abuse and domestic violence. Can you talk about that link, please?
So Benny was a kitten and living in a household in Long Beach. And he was finally brought in at about 7 months old, as I recall, into the local public shelter by the grandmom in the house. It was a multi-generational house, from what I understand. And this is all, kind of third-hand knowledge that I gleaned through, through the whole episode. And as I understand it, there was the young woman and her son, and then there was some sort of, boyfriend in there. And it was the alleged abuser was the boyfriend, and it was pretty grim. I mean, the grandma finally brought Benny in, that wasn't his name at the time, and into the shelter because she knew he would be eventually killed if he stayed in that household. He had, again, trigger warning if you want to. I mean, it's a little tough. He had a fractured jaw. He had a broken pelvis. He had some badly healed, fractures. Old, broken body. Old and new. At just 7 months old, the medical. He couldn't walk. He couldn't eat.
So was he the blackmail, the emotional blackmail?
I do. Who knows what was going
Okay.
on in the household?
This is scary.
But the shelter medical team did, a wonderful job, just, trying to stabilize him, get him comfortable. He was held as evidence for months and months and months. Eventually, the case was dropped because nobody in the house would was willing to testify, to. After witnessing the abuse, there was a little boy that initially had made a statement, but then, when pressed on it by the DA's office, as I understand it, recanted. And one can only infer from that that there was threats, right? And if this is the alleged, we have to say alleged, abuser was, beating the cat and throwing the kitten against the wall and kicking it. What it's kind of a logical, extrapolation to think that, what was going on with the woman and the little boy. The link between domestic violence and animal abuse is well established. The link between animal abuse and other forms of violence towards human is also well researched and established. I mean, the FBI has whole profiles on it. The research has been done among, domestic violence survivors that half of them, if there was animals, if there were animals in the house, half of them, the animals were either injured, killed, or threatened to be killed if the person left, during that. So that often becomes an impediment to the abused leaving. They're afraid to leave. If they can't take their animal, and they can't take their animal if they have no money and nowhere to go, and if the shelters, violence, domestic violence shelters, it can't accommodate pets, they stay sometimes at their own peril.
Yeah, I think it hit home for me just recently. There was an advertisement on a news program for, I think it was a woman's shelter, and the woman was talking about how in the dead of night she bundled up her son and her dog and got away. And I had the thought at the time of like, oh boy, I hope the people shelters take the pets as well. So I guess it's hit and
Yeah,
miss.
some do. I think
Yeah.
there. I mean, there's a movement to try and accommodate in some way the animal involved in that situation, either, with the person in the shelter, or, perhaps at an animal shelter through some sort of safekeeping program. Where they can stay until if and hopefully when the person stabilizes their life and finds somewhere that they can be safely.
Yeah. Okay, let's turn this around. You have a traveling kitty comfort and therapy program.
Yep, this is
Tell
all
us about that.
it's a nice counterpoint to, some of the stuff that we were just discussing, because this one's all happy. And what this is one of our board members has really taken the helm on this program, and what we do is bring kittens into assisted living facilities, which, vary. Sometimes it's, memory care. Sometimes it's, people are just, a little older in mobility, and so we bring them in to, and spend an hour visiting with the residents and cuddling the kittens and, sitting on their laps and petting them. And it's just a nice, it's just a nice feel good, make you feel good about the world kind of thing. The volunteers love it. The staff loves it. That these facilities, I think, the residents, I mean, sometimes sometimes it's really remarkable. And even the staff, remarks on it is that, people who may have had like a stroke or memory issues that are kind of shut down, verbally, and not, really actively engaged. Plop a little kitten, and they just become animated in a way that the staff doesn't usually see them and will, remark and say, "Wow, she's smiling," and it's really profound and heartwarming the way people respond to animals in a way that they don't even to other humans, and
I
so
had a career in elder care, and one of my favorite stories is a dog that I had many years ago was just crazy rambunctious, but all, knew the minute that we walked in the door that she had to just bring it down a notch. And so I had the little tiny, tiny biscuits because so many people wanted to give her treats, and I didn't want her gaining a lot of weight. And we had one woman in care who was totally non-responsive. So the staff would get her up in the morning, they would feed her, like dress her, put her in her wheelchair, feed her, bring her down so that she had community. But there was never anything that was responsive. And so one day I went up, I knew she'd grown up on a farm, so I assumed that she'd had dogs in her life. And I put one of these little tiny biscuits between her thumb and forefinger, and it was just resting in her lap. So my dog, knowing she had to be gentle, went up. And when the dog's nose was literally, I don't know, 3 inches from this little biscuit, the woman palmed it. And I looked at her and I said, "You're teasing my dog." And I took it out of her hand and put it back. And same thing. This happened every time. So still no response, except she remembered how to tease it. She knew how to tease that dog. And the dog was great, you know. And I mean, I would just give her a biscuit so she didn't go crazy. But I just love that whole thing of there is still a person in there somewhere, you
And
know.
that and that's that's so important. I this actually grew out of my own personal experience with a friend of mine who years ago, I think it's even on our website under that program, and she spent her last years in an assisted living home, and she was completely with it mentally, but it had spinal problems and was in a wheelchair the last years of her life in assisted living. And I would bring my own cat in, who was a really friendly, fluffy, one of these just happy, kind of happy tail wagging kind of cats. I used to call her my valley girl. She was a beautiful, beautiful cat. She was like a rag doll mix, and she was just all big eyes and hair, right? Big blue eyes and hair, right? My valley girl. And she just, would get her tail up, and Priscilla would pet her and brush her, and it brought her, I think, some joy in those last years. And they're both long gone now, but that's where that grew out of. And I just watched, I just watched what that brought to her day, to her world as she was experiencing it at that point.
Okay, so I'm putting you in charge of the world. If you could implement equality in every community out there, what would it be?
Wow, empathy. This empathy. I mean, just the ability and capacity to recognize and share the experience of another.
That comes from someone who obviously lives the life you live. I guess I was sort of thinking that there would be, you know, the funding for this big, huge shelter. But I guess if everybody had empathy, everything else grows out of that.
Yeah, I think no, I see what you're saying, and you're thinking of, in a material direct way, and I guess I was thinking more in this like woo-woo spiritually,
Well, no, that's good though, because as I say, you know, if everybody in the world had empathy, oh my goodness.
And I think you're exactly right. I think that there has to, for someone to part with their goods, their money or their time, they have to be in some way moved by something. I mean, something has to speak to them somewhere, right? I mean, money and time are precious commodities. I mean, time more than money. You can get more money, you can't usually get more time. And for someone to be asked to part with either of those things, I think they have to feel some sort of connection to the mission, to the passion, to the needs of another, to being a voice, to being hope for the hopeless and voice for the voiceless. I don't know. So that's kind of a long answer, isn't it? Don't put me in charge of the world again.
Okay, but I am going to take one of your words that you just used. What does give you hope when you also see the really negative side of the coin?
Well, the people that are willing to help. I mean, there's like first-time trackers. I love they come into the clinic, right? And they say, we see these cats and they're out there and they have such hard lives and they have litters and sometimes the kittens, don't make it. And we see that month after month, year after year, and we have to do something. So we watched a video on how to trap. We got a trap and here's the cat. And it's like, yes. Oh
Yeah.
my God, you were someone who did something, right? Someone should do something. And guess what? You were someone. And so that gives me hope. The people that are actually willing to, get into the fray sometimes to put themselves out there. That gives me hope.
If every listener took one action after listening to us talk, what do you hope it would be?
Maybe just that. Maybe just, and then maybe not that, specific thing, but to find something, some need, some suffering somewhere, something that needs to be made a little bit better and make it a little bit better and be willing to do it. People, sometimes use can't, they use the word can't when they really mean won't. I can't do that. The more truth of it is that they won't do that, right? And to just be willing, it all starts with being willing to try. Just be willing to just pick up the flag and march on sometimes. I don't know.
So I guess I keep on telling these stories, but when my children were young, we'd sit down to dinner, and if I saw like a lip curling or something, I'd say, "No, you have to try it, and then tell me you don't like it." So I guess same thing for the listeners, like just don't say I can't do that, I won't do that. Give it a try. If there's a need, give it a try because it may be okay, and it may be something that you end up being really good at. So
Everyone can do can offer something. I believe that everyone has something they can offer. Maybe not all the time, not every day. It can be all consuming, but sometimes just occasionally.
Is there anything we haven't talked about that you really want to impress on mid-age women?
Well, years ago, I think we used to think of ourselves as becoming invisible after a certain age, and I've had that reflection myself, as I've gotten older and I've faced some health issues, cancer, broke a hip last year, couldn't walk, and facing the limitations of my physicality and having to make a choice between am I going to be invisible or will this set me free to just say what I want and do what I want. And I'm kind of choosing the latter path, I think, right? I mean, we don't, after a certain age, maybe as women, we don't necessarily have to abide by the rules anymore. We don't have to limit ourselves, to the construct that society has placed in front of us. We get to color outside the lines. We get to draw the lines, and I think there's power in that.
You keep on surprising me with your answers, and I just love them. Because if just make a choice to do something, and it doesn't have to be directly related to anything that you and I have talked about, but to actually And you can stay within the bounds, some of the social bounds that you've been restricted by, but yeah, you can still make a difference. So, whoa, that's great. Thank you for that. Where do we find you on the World Wide Web?
We are at HelenSandersCatPaws.com
All right.
in Southern California.
But I'm sure you don't mind where the money comes from.
No, I
Are
love
you
my
affiliated
country.
across the country or across the continent? I'm up in Canada, so
Oh, okay.
yeah,
Yeah,
do you
no,
have affiliations?
we're pretty hyper local.
Okay, that's all right.
Well, what we do, and the you know the what we do are it, you can find if people are moved by our mission and want to do something, and there's thousands of rescues all over the country, U.S. and Canada and Mexico and everywhere, and people can it, you know it, they're not in our area and can't do something with us, they can find someone somewhere needs help.
Right. And you're on social, I see. Facebook, Instagram,
Yeah, it's
Twitter.
a, I think it's Facebook / HS Cat Paws, and then Instagram is Helen Sanders Cat Paws,
Okay.
I believe.
Yeah. All righty. What is the Cat Paw News?
Oh, that's our newsletter. That's the email. That's to be on our email, distribution list. Our newsletter that when I get around to putting one out,
Yeah, you know,
whenever I write one, right?
only so many hours in your day, I understand
Yeah,
that.
when I get
Yeah.
around to writing one.
I guess the reason it caught my eye was because I thought, like, do you give tips or hints or, link to a video showing you how to bottle feed a brand new kitten?
Actually, there's one, if I don't have it in front of me, but there's a tab on our website that says something like resources and education, I believe.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
if you drop down on that, there's Help I Found a Cat, there's links to some videos, including articles. There's
Okay.
another one on what is TNR, trap, neuter,
Yeah.
return. There's links to videos on, how,
Okay.
like I said a few minutes ago, how to trap, what is trapping and how to trap. So yeah, there's all kinds. There's even a link on there on pet loss, on grief support and on pet loss, and links to resources for people who are struggling with that.
Yeah,
And
I notice under your programs too that you've got some things that would be, once again, even if people aren't in your locale, they can learn stuff. And we'll have these cat paws all over the continent pretty soon. That's great.
Yeah, no, and I mean, hopefully people can find. I try to, make our website not just, about what we do. There's that, obviously, but also kind of like more broadly educational.
Yeah, I noticed that as I was browsing around. May I ask you a personal question before we close? You're a pilot?
Oh, yeah, student pilot. But yeah, I've flown planes all by myself, little bitty planes.
Where did that come from? Like, was this something you always wanted to do, or?
It was kind of a weird thing. And so in the early mid 80s, throughout the 80s, I was a sales rep, and I flew all over the country, making sales calls and trade shows and whatever. Traveled a lot, right? And somewhere along the way in the late 80s, I had this panic attack on a plane, and it was a perfectly calm day. I mean, there was, blue sky, nothing was happening. And, believe me, by this time I'd been on some bad flights, right? I mean, whatever, but this was not one of them. And I'm just, sitting around and, probably halfway through my third Bloody Mary, who knows? I can't remember back in those days. And, I remember just looking and it was like, and I just had this like, put me down now. And it was so overwhelming and intractable. I tried going to hypnosis. I tried, I mean, this, I had to change careers. I had to change jobs, and cut in pay and find some, admin job where I didn't travel. It was bad. So years passed, and this was really crippling, and it was really starting, I couldn't get over it or around it. So I finally just decided to take flying lessons. And that's how that started. because I just thought I've got to take this on, this thing on hit. I don't know where it came from. I had been a fearless, I went from fearless flyer to panic stricken, and I had to somehow get on the other side of it again. So that's how that started.
Okay, so those bounds of middle-agehood women, you burst through a couple of them then. That sounds
Yeah, I
amazing.
mean, sometimes the only way, around a problem is straight through it.
Yeah. So do you actually get out now and just take yourself for a little toodles around or?
I haven't since COVID hit, and then like I said, I got diagnosed with cancer, and just now starting to get back into some mobility. I don't even know if I can get in and out of one of these little planes
Okay.
to be at this point in the game. But I've been thinking about it more again that I should try and pick it back up again, because it really was it was good. It was exhilarating. I mean, it was because I wanted the first solo flight I did. It was special because I'd have these are little Cessna 172s, and they're tiny, 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 much smaller than any car really. The cockpit of these things. And I remember the first time, I took off. I was in Long Beach Airport, which is commercial, fairly busy airport. Took off and, looked over, and it's like nobody there. Guess what? There's no one there. So I went out, flew over the Pacific, did a few swirls over the Pacific, came back in, landed. So it was
That
like that.
freeing or scary?
It focuses the mind.
It does. There's nobody to save you. There's no one can rescue you.
So I mean, it was one of those. I don't know that I like I said, I don't know that I was scared at that moment. It's just like I need to pay attention here. I don't have that much margin for error right now. So I'm it. So but yeah, but then after that, when I go up by myself, it was fun in its own way. It was a challenge for me. Like I said, it came from a it started from a place of just being it just frustrated with this phobia that had developed. I mean, it's like I said, it's not one I had all my life. I used to fly fearlessly. And it just came out of nowhere, and I was just frustrated and angry that I couldn't, to be controlled by that kind of
Yeah.
fear.
Have you been back on a commercial flight or?
Oh
Oh, okay.
yeah,
So did
yeah,
it do the trick then?
yeah. It did what it needed to do.
Oh, yay.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. Listeners, I told you we were going to end on a good news story.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you for that. Okay. Your website link is in the show notes, and all of your links will be on your page at our website.
Thank
Listeners,
you.
we'd love to hear from you. Have you ever fostered, adopted, volunteered with, or supported an animal rescue organization? What was the experience like? Share your thoughts and stories in the comments because we're going to look at them. If you know someone who loves animals, volunteers in their community, supports rescue organizations, or has ever considered fostering a pet, please share this episode with them. And actually, I just waved my hand. Nobody could see that. But as we get older, I am less, or I'm more reluctant to, shall we say, to actually have a full-time 15-year commitment to a pet. So I've often thought that fostering would be, a really good way to still have a pet in my life. So, anyways, please share the episode. These sorts of conversations help good work travel farther. If you're enjoying these conversations about creating meaningful next chapters and making a difference in the world around us, I'd love to invite you to follow the Boomer Woman's podcast so you never miss an episode. If you'd like to listen early, I release each episode on Substack on Wednesday evening before it goes live everywhere else. Deborah Phelan-McGaldy, thank you for being my guest today and for reminding us that meaningful change often starts with just one person deciding to care. I think that's such an important message. Thank you for sharing Cat Paws with us and how many ordinary people can help create better lives for animals and creatures and ultimately communities, given the fact that you go into the residential communities. So that's great. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Agnes. This has been fun. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Have a great rest of week.